John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, June 22, 2010. French sources, according to Lebanese newspaper Al-Mustaqbal, have knowledge of meetings between Israeli officials and American experts on a possible war with Hezbollah. The Israeli officials were aware that the war would not bring the destruction of Hezbollah, but felt that it was the right strategy to keep Israel safe and reassure its position in the region. It would seem that Israel thinks the show of force would send the message they desired to Iran. Israel maintains that Iran is a nuclear and existential threat. The state likewise views Hezbollah as a ticking time bomb of Iran, with the steady increase of its political and military might within Lebanon. The delegates admitted as well that Hezbollah had not yet acquired Scud missiles and that they did not believe that Syria or Iran would take substantial action on Hezbollah's part in the event of another war. Most of the planning is said to be completed for the operation. From New York comes news that the UN Human Rights Council approved an independent investigation into the attacks on the Turkish ship, the Mavi Marmara. Officials investigating the incident will be looking into potential violations of international law and the attacks themselves. Experts in international law and human rights law were some of those named to the committee responsible for the investigation. This is in contrast with the Israelis' internal investigation, which includes no experts on international law. Israel will be asked to contribute to the investigation. If it does not, its lack of cooperation will be noted in the final report due in September. Gaza City saw a candlelight vigil Monday night in the port. Women from the community gathered in support of the Lebanese ships planning to sail to Gaza and to ending the siege on the Gaza Strip. The protesters waved Palestinian and Lebanese flags while also protesting Israel's planned use of force against the ships. They have been reported to only be carrying humanitarian supplies and women. The Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, phoned his Israeli counterpart on Monday, expressing the Russian government's position favoring an end to the siege in Gaza. He pointed out to the Israeli Foreign Minister that peace, security, and stability within the region requires Israel's implementation of international law. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. You have been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center. For constant update, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Brian Ennis.
Thank you. As the war in Afghanistan becomes ever more violent, the latest headlines in the U.S. press have focused on a public spitting match between U.S.-Afghan War Commander General Stanley McChrystal and the Obama administration. General McChrystal was called back to Washington to respond in person to his staff's insulting criticism of President Obama and senior White House officials quoted in a July 8th Rolling Stone magazine article. But the more important story involves a deteriorating situation in the Afghan war, with an alarming rise in the number of Taliban-organized suicide bombings and assassinations of government officials. This despite 30,000 additional U.S. troops deployed to Afghanistan by President Obama, now totaling 94,000. A major U.S. offensive in the rural area of Marjah in February initially was declared a success, but the Taliban have succeeded in infiltrating back into the area, undermining the Pentagon's clear hold and build strategy. A larger American offensive in the Taliban stronghold of Kandahar province, originally set for June, has been delayed due to the lack of local support and is expected to be launched this fall. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with historian and national security policy analyst Gareth Porter, who in a recent article predicted that the U.S. will soon confront an Iraq 2006 moment, where political support for the Afghan war will evaporate among members of Congress and other elite opinion makers. Here, Porter talks about the unraveling of the Afghan war and the interesting timing of a Pentagon announcement touting Afghans' nearly $1 trillion worth of untapped mineral wealth.
I think that there is a very clear parallel here between the situation that exists politically in the United States today with regard to the war in Afghanistan and the situation that existed in 2006 with regard to Iraq. And the parallel is that in Iraq in 2006, what was happening was that the war was so clearly turning into a sectarian civil war between the Sunnis and the Shia, particularly in Baghdad, that the United States military was powerless to really affect. And the way in which that story played out day after day in the news media was so demoralizing, not just for the U.S. public or primarily for the U.S. public, but rather for the political elite itself in Washington, D.C., members of Congress, the sort of punditry, the unelected elite, the foreign policy elite. All these people were watching this unfold and saying, oh my God, this is no good. This isn't working at all. We've got to do something. We've got to do something different. And this, I think, is already beginning to happen. The same process is beginning to happen in Afghanistan if you understand that the McChrystal strategy, the so-called counterinsurgency strategy, that depended on being able to protect, quote-unquote, the population from the Taliban and thus sort of draw them into a process whereby they would get governance reform and development. This has simply and utterly failed in such an obvious way that I think that the media coverage is bound to begin to pick up the same theme and replay it many times in the coming weeks and months by the very nature of the war itself and the failure of the strategy.
Gareth, President Karzai, Afghan President Karzai, recently held what they call a Loya Jirga summit meeting of Afghan tribal leaders. And President Karzai, he's been saying there is no military solution to this war and that we must sit down with the Taliban. How realistic is it that Karzai or the U.S. government or NATO will entertain the idea of serious negotiations with the Taliban when they appear to be winning on the battlefield?
Well, that, of course, is the single biggest question mark in my own mind about this war, is whether there could be a negotiated settlement, which is really the only realistic way out of this war. I think that the Taliban do, in fact, have an incentive for sitting down and negotiating an agreement that would result in some kind of compromise. The first reason, of course, is that it is perhaps the only way to get U.S. troops out of the country for X number of years into the future. The Taliban obviously have an interest in eliminating the foreign military presence, not simply for political reasons, but because they're Afghans and their fellow Afghans are suffering. So, I mean, I think that that is sufficient reason in itself to bring them to the table. And I would add that there is plenty of evidence that the Taliban leadership has been sending signals, albeit somewhat subtle signals, that the U.S. news media has not seen fit to publish, except for my own writing about this, and Anand Gopal, who wrote one piece for the Wall Street Journal. They have sent signals to the Obama administration that they are willing to meet the single U.S. demand that the U.S. has made explicitly, which is that as part of a settlement, the Taliban has to agree that al-Qaeda cannot have any foothold in Afghan territory. And you hear from many sources that the tensions between Mullah Omar and the Taliban leadership on one hand and the al-Qaeda leadership on the other hand have grown in recent years rather than receding, and that they do not see eye to eye at all on their fundamental interests.
The Pentagon recently made an announcement about Afghanistan's vast riches in mineral wealth, including iron, copper, gold, and lithium. They value it at close to $1 trillion. This information, from what I understand, has been released before. What's behind the Pentagon's timing in releasing this information as the war kind of turns sour?
Well, it's clearly a transparent effort to try to put another reason for the United States staying in Afghanistan for a long, long time on the table. And, you know, my own fear, I have to say, is that it could be successful in the sense that so many people in this country are almost trained like Pavlov's dog to respond to the idea that, if there's wealth, there's mineral wealth there that is valuable to the U.S. economy, then of course the United States either is going to have to stay, should stay, on one hand, that's sort of the center and the right, or the left saying, well, of course we shouldn't, but that's the way the United States is. Of course we're going to stay, and there's nothing to be done about it. And I think someone really has to stop and say, now, hold on a minute, there's no good reason for the United States to stay at all. It makes no difference whatsoever to the U.S. economy whether the Chinese are making deals to have mining of various kinds of minerals in Afghanistan or not. They're still going to go on the world market and we'll get whatever we want to pay for. And so this is all just irrelevant to the real issues that we need to face in Afghanistan.
That was Gareth Porter, historian, national security policy analyst, and author of the book Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power and the Road to War in Vietnam. Read his articles online at ipsnews.net.
Today I accepted General Stanley McChrystal's resignation as commander of the International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan. I did so with considerable regret, but also with certainty that it is the right thing for our mission in Afghanistan, for our military, and for our country. I'm also pleased to nominate General David Petraeus to take command in Afghanistan. As difficult as it is to lose General McChrystal, I believe that it is the right decision for our national security. The conduct represented in the recently published article does not meet the standard that should be set by a commanding general. It undermines the civilian control of the military that is at the core of our democratic system.
On the same day, General McChrystal was sacked for challenging the president's authority over the military. NATO reported the deaths of 8 soldiers killed Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday in Afghanistan. Afghanistan today. The BBC is reporting that 4 British soldiers were killed in a helicopter with gunfire involved in Afghanistan late yesterday or today. They were not in the earlier series of NATO reports that came out yesterday, which did not mention a helicopter crash or a shootdown. As of right now, that makes July 2010 the deadliest month in the history of the war for occupation soldiers in Afghanistan, with 12 killed just this week. American soldiers are still dying in Iraq, too. Iraq, yesterday, multinational force Iraq, meaning the U.S. military, reported the death of a multinational division Baghdad soldier from a non-combat-related injury in an undisclosed location in Iraq on Monday, the 21st of June. Is this another GI suicide or another cover-up? In addition, American soldiers are still killing innocent people in Iraq. Mosul, Iraq, 22nd of June. Three people from one family were killed, and three others of the same family were wounded when a U.S. vehicle ran them over in the northwest of Mosul City. Quote, the incident occurred yesterday evening on the highway northwest of Mosul City, a local security source told Aswan El Iraq News Agency on Wednesday. He noted that the family's father and mother died in the incident, in addition to their daughter. Mr. Barack Obama, now's the time to cap this spewing gusher of blood. Bring all the troops home from both Iraq and Afghanistan today.
And no amount of money you could give me, honey, couldn't pay me, ain't going back again. I ain't going back again. I ain't going back again. You won't see me back there again. No, you won't see me back there again.
Suppose Army recruiting ads had to have side effect warnings like drug advertisements on TV do.
The United States Army may not be right for every patient. Side effects can include distress, disillusionment, bitter resentment, isolation, traumatic and post-traumatic stress, sociopathic behavior, uncontrollable sobbing, uncontrollable violence, prosecutions for war crimes, prosecutions for domestic crimes, loss of contact with loved ones, loss of ability to love, brain injuries, blindness, depleted uranium poisoning, flashbacks, horror of death, horror of being away from death, loss of the use of limbs, loss of limbs, death, suicide, excruciating pain, the desire to feel excruciating pain, overwhelming rage and misery, loss of hearing, punishment by the Army for failure to obey illegal orders, punishment by courts of law or by enemy forces for obeying illegal orders, torture, humiliation, shame, dangerous habits of blind subservience, or the wasting of what could have been the best years of your life. If you experience any of these symptoms, deal with it, sucker. You already signed your name on the dotted line.
One of President Obama's first pledges upon taking office was that within his first year, he would close the prison at Guantanamo Bay U.S. Naval Base in Cuba, which held hundreds of Bush-era war on terror suspects. That deadline was January 21st, 2010. On January 11th of this year, the 8th anniversary of the first terrorism suspects being transferred to Guantanamo in 2002, 45 protesters with the group, witnessed against torture, began a fast in a church near the White House, which lasted 11 days, ending on January 21st. During that time, the group held many public protests to draw attention to their cause, aimed at pressuring President Obama to fulfill his pledge to close the Guantanamo prison camp. On January 21st, 24 Witness Against Torture activists brought their protest to the U.S. Capitol and were subsequently arrested for unlawful entry with disorderly conduct. After a trial in a Washington, D.C. Superior Court, those arrested were acquitted of all charges by Judge Russell Kanin on June 14th. Mark Coville, who runs the Catholic Worker House in New Haven, Connecticut, has been involved with Witness Against Torture for several years, including a trip to Guantanamo he made with other peace activists in December 2005 to visit prisoners held there, an effort blocked by the U.S. military. Here, Coville talks about some disturbing facts related to prisoner suicides at Guantanamo that influenced activists' decision to risk arrest, and how the judge in the trial arrived at his decision to acquit him and the other anti-torture defendants in the case.
During the time that we had been doing the 11-day fast, there was a revelation that came out about the death of three detainees that had died in, I'm going to say, 2006, I believe it was. Three detainees at Guantanamo were reported to have committed suicide. And a whistleblower among the military personnel that were on duty that night had come forward, and in an article in Harper's Magazine, which eventually came out in February of this year, it was exposed that all evidence points to the fact that these three were murdered by torture by the military personnel, and that the story of suicides was just a lie. One of the detainees was actually brought into Guantanamo when he was still a minor, and none of them had any connection to terrorism. The action on the 21st, a group of us decided that we would go inside the Capitol, and we'd go on the tour. And during the tour, you stop in the rotunda, and there's a particular spot where presidents, when they're waked, they lie in state in the middle of the rotunda, where, you know, long processions go by and view the president's casket. Well, we went to that spot, and we laid down a banner with the names of these three people who had been murdered, and we did a service of repentance, some funeral prayers. And so it was a solemn ritual that we felt was important to do as an act of repentance on behalf of our nation. And we were arrested, obviously.
Mark Coville, you said an attorney working with your group had asked the judge to allow the necessity defense, that is, that you acted in order to try to prevent a worse catastrophe, which was the torture of prisoners at Guantanamo and at secret sites around the world. The judge, as is almost always the case, denied that motion. What happened next?
Three of us on the defendant's side rose and gave motions to the judge to acquit, and we were surprised to hear the judge considering these motions. Usually they're dismissed out of hand. But the judge asked a lot of questions of the prosecution before answering, and then in the end he ended up accepting one of the motions for acquittal. And his reasoning was that the prosecution hadn't proven specifics of the statute, particularly things involving threatening behavior and disruption. And he basically was, the way he was explaining it was that we were charged improperly by the prosecution. To most of us who were present, it did appear that the judge was had been moved by the justice of our cause, and he had been looking for a way to get through this without convicting us. I don't know. Obviously that's speculation, but it became a victory of sorts, although as we all said when we walked out of the courtroom, we hope and pray that the detainees that still remain at Guantanamo can get afforded the same kind of treatment. First of all, a hearing in court, and then secondly, the feeling of being set free, which we were that day.
Do you see any difference between the Bush and Obama administration's policies regarding prisoners at Guantanamo?
The short answer to your question is no, and that's really discouraging to folks, is that there has been dialogue with the Obama administration. We feel that there's been listening going on from the other side, which is a substantive kind of change from the Bush administration. But as far as policy and practice, nothing has changed. And this is really, it's bewildering to progressive people who have been, during those 8 years of Bush administration, were just longing for change. And then the strong promise that appeared to be there with Obama's election. And I must say that policy-wise, nothing to this point has changed, to be honest. And everybody is obviously hoping that that it will, but we can't say that anything has changed to this point.
That was Mark Colville of the New Haven Catholic Worker, La Casa Amistad, and Witness Against Torture. For more information on the group's anti-torture campaign, visit their website at witnesstorture.org.
For more than half of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, opponents of the wars have been holding a vigil outside Walter Reed Army Hospital every Friday from 7 to 9 p.m. So, how have the anti-war vigils at Walter Reed Army Hospital been going?
We are a steadfast vigil. We will be here as long as the United States is putting our young men and women and intervening in foreign countries and putting them in harm's way. We will be here. We will be here, to draw our last breath. We get support. So much support from the neighbors and the community, people who are returning from work, honk for us, stop and talk to us, the soldiers and their families stop and give us support.
And I saw that one of the right-wingers had a sign that said, troops, troops, nothing but troops. That sounds like their approach to foreign policy.
Well, I think their dream of the future is endless war. Endless war and endless war profiteering.
Yeah, I wonder if any of them have investments in the arms industry.
Well, they certainly don't seem to be investing their bodies where their, where their signs are.
Oh, that's right. They're over here and not over there, aren't they?
Yeah.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQT Radio@hushmail.com, WSQT Radio@hushmail.com. On the 17th of June, corner cutting, oil spewing, BP CEO Tony Hayward found he could not escape the wrath of the people. Diane Wilson, member of Code Pink and a fourth generation shrimper, shouted him down in Congress.
Out there, you need to be charged with a crime. You need to go to jail.
Oh, I want to get away. I want to fly away.
Yeah, Tony, I'll bet you do want to fly away, but you belong in prison after what you've done to the Gulf of Mexico. Diane Wilson was arrested for her courageous stand against BP. When BP's CEO Tony Hayward was called before Congress to testify, but it should have been Tony Hayward arrested on the stand for what he's done to the Gulf of Mexico. There was also a disgusting note in the hearing when right-wing Republican nutjob Joe Bart had the nerve to call a $20 billion pittance BP is offering after meeting with the president, quote, a shakedown.
Amounts to a shakedown. So I apologize.
Mr. Joe Barton, how about you apologize for 20 years of drill baby drill that helped make BP's spill possible? And wouldn't you know, right after Tony Hayward stood before Congress to get this? Right after that, it was off to the yacht races for Tony Hayward, who did indeed fly away, all the way to the Isle of Wight off Britain, to have a good time out on the water, while oil workers desperately scrambled to plug his gusher of crude, while protesters deployed to BP gas stations all over the world, and while fishermen and shrimpers like Diane Wilson were out of work because the fishing grounds and the shrimping grounds are closed, filled with oil, and everything alive is probably dying or dead. Mr. Tony Hayward, how about you go down to the Gulf of Mexico with a spoon and eat every last one of those goddamn tar balls?
With British Petroleum's oil spill continuing to devastate the environment and the economy of the Gulf of Mexico, President Obama, in his first Oval Office address, spoke with the American people about his response to the single worst environmental disaster in American history. During his speech, Obama pledged to make BP pay for the damage it has caused along the Gulf Coast and criticized the company for its recklessness. The following day, Obama met with BP officials and secured an agreement to create a $20 billion escrow fund that will be tapped to compensate individuals and businesses that have suffered economic damage due to the oil spill. In a testament to how many friends money can buy, more than a few Republican legislators who receive big oil campaign contributions criticized Obama's pressure on BP to set aside the $20 billion to pay victims of the oil spill. Representative Joe Barton, Republican of Texas, was by far BP's best friend when at a House Energy Committee hearing on June 17th, he apologized to BP CEO Tony Hayward for what he described as a shakedown by the White House to set up the $20 billion escrow fund. Reprimanded by Republican leaders worried about a public backlash against the pro-corporate stance of the GOP, Barton later retracted his apology to BP. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Russell Mokyber, editor of the Corporate Crime Reporter, who criticized President Obama for not advocating criminal prosecution of BP executives. Here, Mokyber explains why he favors revocation of BP's U.S. corporate charter and excluding the company from being awarded any future government contracts.
Well, it's not a question of law. It's a question of resources and political will. And unfortunately, it doesn't look like the federal government has the political will to apply the resources. It has the resources. Just a little bit of background. A former head of the Environmental Crimes Unit at the Justice Department, who we interviewed a couple years ago, David Allman, says that, bringing these cases is definitely possible under the current law. In fact, he sent to prison executives of a major slaughterhouse from South Dakota for dumping slaughterhouse waste in a river in South Dakota a couple years ago. But when he went to court to prosecute the case, it was him and a young graduate assistant who was working at the Justice Department at the time, sitting at one table, and 14 high-paid corporate white-collar defense lawyers sitting representing the executives in the company at the other table. So the companies have the money and are willing to spend the money to defend themselves. And the question is the government willing to spend the money to prosecute these cases? And more importantly, does it have the political will? So I saw a recent poll saying that 75% of Americans think that Obama's not tough enough on BP. And I think what they mean is that there's no talk of putting these executives in prison. Obama didn't once mention the word crime or criminal justice or justice during his Oval Office TV speech on BP. And even though there is a federal criminal investigation, there's not much emphasis on bringing these executives to justice. And it's not going to be an easy case in the sense that BP is going to throw everything at it and the government's going to have to do the same. Eric Holder, who's the Attorney General, and his deputies are part of what I call Corporate Crime, Inc. So they're part of the business of prosecuting and defending and cutting these slap-on-the-wrist deals for corporations. And Holder, for years, was in private practice representing corporate criminal defendants, and so were his deputies. And so, you know, there's a revolving door of executives going from the defense side to the prosecution side. And if you don't play ball, you're not going to go back to the defense side. And by playing ball, that means, you know, not putting executives in jail when they deserve to be in jail. It means entering these deferred and non-prosecution agreements when you should be insisting on criminal pleas. So the signs are not good that there will be justice in the BP case for the people of the Gulf and for the Gulf itself.
Russell Mokyber, tell us a little bit about British Petroleum's history of criminal activity in other spots beyond the Gulf of Mexico. What have they been doing over the last bunch of years?
Well, yeah, you see, so there is a history, and that's why some people believe that the corporate death penalty is called for here, that the state of Delaware, where BP is incorporated, should revoke BP's corporate charter. And send the company packing back to the UK, seize its assets and apply the assets to the creditors, which primarily are going to be the residents of the Gulf who've lost their livelihood, and for the cleanup of the Gulf. BP is a corporate criminal recidivist corporation. There was an oil spill in the North Slope of Alaska where BP pled guilty to a crime. There was another case where the company was convicted also on the North Slope of hazardous waste violations. Third case in Texas City, Texas, where 15 workers were killed after an explosion. There was a guilty plea in that case. There was a deferred prosecution agreement in a propane price rigging case. So, yeah, there are a lot of options on the table. I think it's still a sort of fluid situation where, you know, the government, Obama administration, wants to limit the liability of the corporation. That's why they've hired Mr. Limited Liability himself, Ken Feinberg, to administer this $20 billion fund. He was very much involved with the Agent Orange case, where he sought to protect the interests of the corporations who manufactured Agent Orange. And so this is the way the government seeks to preserve corporate capital in these disasters. But even people like Robert Reich have argued that BP should put into some kind of environmental receivership, and the government should take control of the assets until we get some kind of resolution.
That was Russell McIver, editor of Corporate Crime Reporter. Visit the publication's website at corporatecrimereporter.com.
On the 19th of June, protesters showed up outside the BP gas station at 13th and N Streets in D.C., protesting BP's mammoth oil spill in the Gulf. This protest is not against any one franchise of BP. This protest is against BP's corporation. This station can easily pick up another franchise after BP goes bankrupt. But for BP to go bankrupt, people need to remember, don't buy gas at BP!
Boycott BP! Boycott BP! Boycott BP!
We got people coming in to buy gas at BP, even while people are here to remind them not to. Everybody knows what's wrong in the Gulf of Mexico with BP's oil blowout, yet here we got selfish drivers buying gas from BP when there are plenty of other gas stations in town.
Boycott!
Ain't that about right? The Grim Reaper set up at a BP station, symbolic of all the damage BP has done.
While protesters were deploying the BP gas stations, and oil workers desperately struggling to clean up BP's mess, guess where BP CEO Tony Hayward was reported to be going? Off to the yacht races, off Britain's Isle of Wight, to watch somebody else sail his yacht in a race. Out on the water to have a good time, while other people were desperately trying to save the water in the Gulf of Mexico. Boycott British Petroleum. Boycott BP.
Well, DNA, it's natural, it's the building block of life. And when the good Lord put it together, you know, I think he did it upright. He made lots of different organisms, a complex web of life. Each one depended on another, and so the circle, it closed up tight. But then along came a man and a microscope, and he separated the genes. And when he put them all back together, he made lots of strange, unnatural things. And now food crops grow on the ocean floor. Cows, they grow on trees. Now the ranchers gaze while their oysters graze on grass that depends on a hormone spray in our genetically modified world.
On the 23rd of June, protesters against puppet killing, Huntington Life Sciences, were harassed by police outside the offices of Novartis, AstraZeneca, and Bayer. I guess they don't like Bayer and next-door neighbor Sanofi of Venice being called out for their past as part of IG Farben, makers of Cyclone B, as well as for their puppy-killing ways as customers of Huntington Life Sciences.
This is not public property.
Yes, it's public.
This is public property. Okay.
Hear me out. It's public property. We're four people standing still. My whole point is walk, because if people come in, they're going to try to sit your block. So walk.
Oh, Lord, yeah. What a pile of hooey. Not only does D.C. not have a sit-lie ordinance, D.C. doesn't have an ordinance that makes it illegal to stand still on a sidewalk. The cops have used this kind of stuff for years when they don't like protesters, but you cannot be arrested for standing still on a sidewalk. You have to actually block somebody before you're legally guilty of so-called incommoding, which sounds like stopping up a toilet to me.
That's more
absurd. Oh, yeah. Sounds to me like what the pharmaceutical lobbyists in these buildings really don't like is having their dirty laundry hung out to dry.
Is that something you really want to know about that? Really? It's about running a corporation and you were protesting these
daily attacks. Sanofi of Venice, Novartis, AstraZeneca, and Bayer. If you don't like the heat, get out of the kitchen. Dump Huntington Life Sciences. Because here in D.C. there's no sleep for the wicked. This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Your name?
Latoya Adams.
Latoya Adams, talk about the fight you've been through this past month to hold on to your home.
Well, it's been a nightmare. We've had to deal with the contractors from the bank breaking into our home and destroying our locks and leaving our window open for anyone to come in and take whatever they wanted to. We've been getting threatening letters for months now saying that we could be evicted at any point in time. So it's been a constant struggle. And it's been really stressful. Like whenever someone comes to the door, it's almost like, are we going to be evicted? It's been a nightmare.
You have two kids, including Naja, who is sitting on your lap right now.
Mm-hmm. I have a four-year-old, and Naja is 4 months.
And how, if at all, have they been impacted by these past months?
My son was actually here when we came home one night, and the door was, at the time, we thought that someone had broken in. I thought, you know, someone broke into our house, and that was really stressful, having to explain to him that someone we didn't know was in the house doing God knows what. So that was really traumatizing for him. And then not to mention the day after they broke in, I went into labor with Naja. So it's been what was supposed to be a happy time for us to just welcome the new life into the world, and has turned out to be really stressful, not knowing where we were going to live and what was going to happen, who's going to come to the door and try to kick us out of the house. And it's been a lot to deal with.
Latoya Adams, when you said they came to the door, and who's the they who broke into your home and the day before you gave birth to Naja, who is this?
We were told that Deutsche Bank hires out contractors to secure the property, So they would be, they came to, well, they're supposed to, if they see that a house is occupied, then they're supposed to back off and let the bank know that the house is occupied, someone's living there, and then the bank has to go through whatever proceedings they have to go through to evict the person out of the house. These contractors, they, I don't, it's, it was obvious because the house is, I mean, it's just like it was in March. We had, my son's toys were out in the front and there was trash in the trash can, and it's obvious that somebody was living here. But they anyway decided to drill a hole in the door and broke into the house. I guess once they realized that there's still furniture in here, there's still people living in here, then they decided to leave. They left from the back window all the way in the back. They left my window wide open. But they had the, I guess, the courtesy to lock the bottom lock of the door so no one else could get in, but they left the window open. It took us a while to figure out who actually did it, but we had another, I guess, a couple weeks ago, we had somebody who came, same contractors came to I guess vacate the house and clean the property again, but this time I answered the door, and I don't know what would have happened if I didn't answer the door, and they, you know, if we weren't home. So it's, we, and I think I spoke to him about what happened last time, and he said it wasn't him and he doesn't know what I'm talking about and blah blah blah. But yeah, I'm not, I have a work order and I have a name of the company that came by the last time, but we have not been able to, I filed a police report, but all he said was, I'm sorry that happened, and you know, they weren't supposed to come into the house, but nothing else. We haven't heard from them or anything. And if I hadn't talked to the neighbors, and I honestly would have thought that that it was a burglar that came in, but I spoke to the neighbors and they told me that there was someone who came by in like a work truck and they had equipment and they moved some of our possessions out to the front of the lawn. And that's how we figured out that it wasn't a random, I guess, attempted burglary.
And it's not clear that it's even Deutsche Bank from this letter that was sent to you, dated 5/18/2010. Dear occupant, it reads, the party that bought your house at the foreclosure sale has authorized me to offer you a cash incentive to vacate the property. If you're interested, please call me immediately, as I need to advise the new owners within 24 to 48 hours of your decision. If you do not accept, the eviction process will begin immediately. Thank you, Faith M. Roselle. And then there was another one with the same date. This one stuck to your door. Please be advised that the person who purchased your home at the foreclosure sale would like possession of their property immediately. And it continues. This doesn't mention Deutsche Bank here.
No. When I spoke to her, she said she was a realtor, but she's in contact with Deutsche Bank. She called me last week and let me know that the bank wanted to know exactly how many people were living in the property. And so she's in contact with the bank, but she doesn't. And when I told her that I obtained a lawyer, she hasn't called back since. So, and I haven't had any letters on the door or anything like that since. So I'm assuming that she's the person who they assigned to sell the property or something after they got possession of it. Because every time I speak to her, it's always, she's pressuring me to move.
LaToya Adams, that's very interesting that since you've gotten yourself a lawyer, Matt Hill with the Center for Public Justice, mm-hmm. is it? That the people, the efforts have changed and seems to have stopped. I want to take a few steps back and explain to folks how you came into the situation. What was it? Your grandmother passed, mm-hmm. and you were able to put $10,000 down and to the landlord. But talk about all that and how we got to this point.
We saw the house. Thought the house was perfect from the outside. It looked nice, needed a little work, you know, in the front, but it looked perfect. I just had my son. He was a couple months old at the time, and we thought it would be a good idea to look for a house. When we came upon this house, I talked to the landlord, and we told him we were interested in buying it. He disclosed to us all the issues, and some of them, a lot of them were visible. So we agreed that we wouldn't buy the house at that point in time. We would rent the house out, and he would make the necessary repairs. And then we would buy the house from him. And by the time, but then after that, we started getting all the foreclosure letters, and he obviously wasn't paying the mortgage like he was supposed to. So we, at this point, we're not really sure. I don't know. At this point, we're not interested in buying the property anymore. It's been too much of a nightmare. Like, even if we could buy it from the bank, we're not interested. There's so many things wrong with the house, and there's issues with the furnace and the hot water heater and everything that we've had to. Everything that we've needed in the house, we've had to basically purchase ourselves. He's not really helped us out with anything. And then on top of that, we now have the bank trying to, we're trying to evict us. So at this point, we're done. We're finished.
Well, it's not just Deutsche Bank, which has been giving you a difficult time. I want to read from an important notice. The Circuit Court for Prince George's has entered a judgment awarding possession of the property, and then it says in all capital letters, you could be evicted from the property on any day after May 10th, 2010. So it's not just that you're being pressured by the bank, whether they say it's the bank or not, but it's also, in this case, the Circuit Court. And can you also talk about your conversations with the sheriff's office? It's very interesting how little they seem to know about the new laws that have been passed.
I spoke with, the day that I got that letter, I was panicked, and I'm calling around because at this point I'm thinking they're going to come and evict me. So I called the sheriff's office, and I basically asked, how long does it take for an eviction to go through? And, you know, do you have my address on your list of evictions? And, you know, what's the schedule like? And so I spoke to, I don't know if she was a receptionist or who she was, but I know she said, I asked her, I think I said, I have a lease, and I have nothing to do with the foreclosure, you know, that's gone on to my property. I said I have a valid lease with my landlord, but the house is under foreclosure. And she said, yeah, you know, that happens all the time. She said, but basically, once the bank gets possession, that's it. I said, even if I have a lease, she said, no. Once the bank, as soon as we get the court order, we just go ahead and execute it. So. After that, you know, I hung up with her, and I looked online, and I saw the Obama Helping,
Is it Helping Families Stay in Their Home Act?
Yeah. So I found that, and I called back, and I spoke to her again, and she said, well, I said, is there anyone else that I can speak to? And she said, yeah, I'll put you in, I'll give you the number to the sheriff who handles all the evictions. So I spoke to him, and he told me that basically he didn't know anything about the act that Obama signed. That he said he does up to 40 foreclosure evictions a day. As a matter of fact, the woman told me, she said, we do the foreclosure houses first because they're easier to do than the apartments. So
I'm sorry, did he say 40 a day?
He said 40 a day. He said he's up to doing 40 foreclosures a day. And he said, I've never heard of Obama's law. He said, you know, if you take, you know, if I said, I'm looking it up on the internet, it's right here. And he said, He said, well, you know, if you have a lawyer, you tell your lawyer to call me and show me the actual law. And he said, because I'd love to not have to do all these evictions. And he said, you know, that'll lighten my workload. So that was the extent of our conversation. I didn't, it surprised me that he didn't know. Like, he sounded like he had no clue, and he's basically been, he's basically been evicting people even if they have valid leases. And I kind of feel like if I hadn't contacted the lawyer and if I didn't look online, I probably would be among those people who were evicted illegally. It sounds like it seems like it's illegal.
The sheriff doesn't know the law.
No. Mm-mm.
You're patting Naja on the back, your 4-month-old daughter. She's had some health issues.
She's got acid reflux she was born with, and seems like she's always congested, always. We have a really, really severe problem with water in our basement, and I'm pretty sure that has something to do with the fact that she's always congested.
Latoya Adams, what do you want to say to the legislators? And it's clear that the courts need to get educated, and the sheriff's office. It's not just, it seems, that banks are misbehaving badly, but there seems to be a lack of government awareness on all fronts about what's going on. What do folks in the government need to know?
That these are people's lives. These are their homes. You know, we've spent 5 years trying to build life here, and because somebody doesn't know the law here, or somebody just doesn't care there, we could be out on the street. And I'm pretty sure there are plenty of families out there that have met the same fate and worse. I guess I would say to just put yourself in our shoes. Like, I haven't done anything wrong. I've paid my rent on time. I've tried to be, a good tenant, and it's not right for people to just, it's like there's no respect or no, I don't know. It's really disheartening. So I guess I would say put yourself in that person's shoes, because I have a family. I have a daughter who's, I have a baby. I have a 4-year-old, and now we have to figure out what we're going to, we basically have to start over now.
And just to say what you've already said, you were paying your rent to your landlord. The property was foreclosed on by the banks, but Obama's legislation means that you can stay here until throughout the life of the lease, and yet you have just faced, I'm not a lawyer, I don't know if that's a legal term, but it seems like you've been harassed.
Mm-hmm.
You fear going to the mailbox?
Definitely. Every day when I go to the mailbox, I'm like, what now? Or every day when someone pulls up to the driveway. We live on the corner house, so people always pull up and then they turn around. I'm like, who is that and what do they want? It's always something. Like, if people are, there's a bus stop in front of the house and there's people that stop and, you know, wait for their kids, and I'm like looking to see, you know, what are they doing? Are they coming to serve me, or what's happening? It's been a nightmare.
Newly elected British Prime Minister David Cameron has apologized for the killing of 14 civilians by British soldiers 38 years ago on Bloody Sunday in Derry, Northern Ireland, during a civil rights march. Speaking in Parliament, Cameron embraced the conclusions of the official Seville report on Bloody Sunday. The Tory Prime Minister declared the events 38 years ago were unjustified and unjustifiable. It was wrong. The 5,000-page inquiry concluded that none of the 14 civilians on January the 30th, 1972, carried a gun, and no warnings were given by British troops, no soldier was under threat, and the soldiers were the first to open fire. Bloody Sunday marked the largest military killing of civilians in the United Kingdom since the Peterloo massacre in 1819. According to the Guardian newspaper, Northern Ireland's Director of Public Prosecutions is now investigating whether to bring charges against the soldiers for murder, perjury, or perverting the cause of justice. The civil report reversed the conclusions by the now discredited report by Lord Widgery in 1972, which accused the Bloody Sunday victims of having guns or bombs. Currently, there is no evidence to support these conclusions. Joe Duddy, a brother of one of the 14 people killed on Bloody Sunday, observed, "The Widgery report destroyed our loved ones' good name. Today, we clear them." Bloody Sunday led to a wave of political violence that consumed Northern Ireland for nearly 30 years.
Toronto, Canada. Beginning tomorrow, the 25th of June, the G20, a conspiracy to defend Wall Street at the expense of Main Street, will attempt to meet. Protesters are swarming forth to greet them, just as it did in Pittsburgh last September, when the G20 met there. The Toronto Police Department has acquired 4 Whale Wars-style LRAD sound cannon and a water cannon in what will surely be a futile attempt to stop the protests. As police harassment rapidly escalates in the streets of Toronto, protest organizers have launched a preemptive first strike of their own, seeking a court injunction against the use of the weapon function on those 4 LRADs. If successful, that'll leave the Toronto pigs with only their water cannon, their rubber bullets, their tear gas, and their billy clubs to try and stop the fight. The last G20 meeting in Pittsburgh, this strategy didn't work very well. When the cops started shooting at protesters with rubber bullets, blasting them with the LRAD, and beating people with billy clubs, furious protesters responded by smashing windows in banks and corporate chain stores. Hear that, G20? You Wall Street at the expense of Main Street bureaucrats. Your cops threw everything they had at us in Pittsburgh, and we're coming back for more in Toronto, Canada. You bring the Whale Wars sound cannon, we'll bring the fight.